Is it in fact your desire to withdraw your petition?
Might as well, Borders said. It ain't fucking going anywhere.
Very well, the judge said. The matter before the court is withdrawn. Deputy Garza, you can take Mr. Borders out of here, but keep him in holding. I believe the detectives here may want to talk to him.
The judge gestured toward Soto and Tapscott.
Garza nodded to the two deputies seated behind Borders, and they moved in on the convict to unlock the lead chain and remove him. As he was stood up, Borders took a last look down at Lance Cronin.
Thanks for the road trip, he said. Better than 3 days in the cage.
Get him out, Houghton ordered loudly. Fuck you all very much, Borders called out as he was half-walked, half-carried through the door into the courthouse holding area. And please tell my girls to stay in touch.
The door banged closed and the sharp metal-on-metal reverb rolled through the courtroom like an earthquake.
Cronin stood slowly to address the court, but Houghton cut him off as well.
Counselor, I advise you not to speak, he said. Anything you say here could be used against you later in another court of law.
But, Your Honor, if I may, Cronin insisted, I need to put on the record how my client threatened me and my family and—
Enough, Mr. Cronin. Enough. I've heard more than I need in order to know that you, your co-counsel, and your client came in this courtroom today with the clear intent of manipulating the court for financial gain, not to mention gaining the release into society of what appears to have been a rightfully convicted murderer and tarnishing the reputation of a veteran police detective.
I'm not speaking to hear myself talk, Mr. Cronin. I told you to be quiet. One more interruption, and I will have you silenced.
Houghton surveyed the entire court before bringing his eyes back to Cronin and continuing.
Now I am assuming that the Los Angeles Police Department will have an interest in talking to you, as well as to Terrence Spencer. Criminal charges may arise from that. I don't know. I can't control that. But what I can control is what happens in this courtroom. And I have to say that never, in my 21 years on the bench, have I seen such a concerted effort to undermine the rule of law by attorneys appearing before me. Therefore, I find Lance Cronin and Catherine Cronin in criminal contempt of this court and order them taken into custody forthwith. Deputy Garza, you need to call a female court deputy in here as soon as possible to take custody of Ms. Cronin.
Catherine Cronin immediately collapsed onto her husband's shoulder in tears. As Bosch watched, her emotions shifted, and soon she was pounding a fist into her husband's chest. He corralled her with his arms and pulled her into an embrace that stopped the pummeling and only left the tears. Deputy Garza walked up behind him, handcuffs dangling from one hand, ready to take him back into the jail.
"Now, Mr. Kennedy," Houghton said, "I don't know what you're planning to do with the information Mr. Holler has brought to light, but I know what I am going to do. I'm going to call members of the media and the public back into the courtroom and tell them exactly what happened in here today. You're not going to like it, because you and your agency are not going to come off too well, considering it was a defense lawyer and his investigators who put this together under the nose of the LAPD and assorted other agencies. But I'll say this. Your office owes Detective Bosch a big, fat apology. And I will be watching to make sure you give it on a big stage in a timely manner and without any buts or becauses or asterisks attached. Nothing short of full exoneration of the suspicions and allegations that were published in Sunday's newspaper will suffice. Do I make myself clear on that, Mr. Kennedy?
Yes, Your Honor, Kennedy said. We would be doing that even if you had not ordered it.
Houghton frowned.
Knowing what I know about politics and the justice system, I find that highly unlikely.
The judge scanned the room again, found Bosch, and asked him to stand.
Detective, I imagine you have been put through the wringer in recent days, he said. I want to apologize on behalf of the court for this needless torment. I wish you the best of luck, sir, and you are welcome in my courtroom anytime.
Thank you, Your Honor, Bosch said.
Two deputies, including a female, entered through the holding area door and joined Garza in taking the Cronins into custody. The judge instructed his clerk to go out into the hallway to tell those waiting that they could return to the courtroom. An hour later, Houghton adjourned his court for the day, and Kennedy was left to wade through the gaggle of reporters who demanded his comments in reaction to what the judge had just announced. Out in the hallway, Bosch watched Soto and Tapscott approach Terrence Spencer and take him into custody. Sisko came up next to Bosch, and they watched the detectives lead Spencer down the hall.
"I hope he tells them how he rigged the box," Bosch said. "I really want to know."
"Not going to happen," Sisko said. "He's taking the Fifth."
"But you said he was going to testify."
"What are you talking about?"
"Your text to Holler in the courtroom. You said he was ready to testify."
"No, I said you can put him on the stand, but he'll take the nickel."
"Why? What did Mick say?"
Bosch stared across the hallway at Holler, who was talking one-on-one with a reporter writing in a notebook. There was no camera, so Bosch assumed it was a print reporter, which most likely meant he was from the Times.
"Son of a gun," he said.
"What?" Sisko asked.
"I saw him read your text, and then he told the judge that Spencer was ready to go on the stand. He didn't exactly say he would testify, only that he'd go on the stand. He tipped the whole thing with that bluff. Borders took the bait and blew a gasket. That was it."
"Smooth move."
"Dangerous move."
Bosch continued to stare at Holler, and he started to put things into place.
Chapter 40. After all the interviews were over, Team Bosch decided to get out of the courthouse and walk over to Tracks and Union Station to celebrate the across-the-board victory. While Holler and Sisko went into the restaurant to get a table, Bosch walked his daughter down to the ramp to the Metrolink train she was due to board. She had bought a return ticket on her app.
"I'm so glad I was here, Dad," Maddie said.
"I'm glad you were here, too," Bosch said.
"And I'm sorry if it sounded like I ever doubted you."
"Nothing to be sorry about, Mads. You didn't."
He pulled her into a long embrace and looked up the tunnel to the sunlight, waiting at the boarding platform. He kissed the top of her forehead and let her go.
"I still want to come down for dinner when you get back to your house. I'll get the app and take the train."
"Definitely. Bye, Dad."
"Bye, sweetie."
He watched her walk up the ramp to the light. She knew he would, and she returned at the top to wave. She was entirely in silhouette, and then she was gone. Bosch joined his lawyer and his investigator in a booth next to a window that looked out on the train station's waiting area of mixed Art Deco and Moorish designs. Holler had already ordered martinis all around. They clinked glasses and toasted. The Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. Bosch caught Holler's eyes and nodded. His attorney apparently didn't interpret it as the thank you he felt he deserved.
"What?" Holler asked.
"Nothing," Bosch said.
"No, what? What was that look you gave me?"
"What look?"
"Don't bullshit me."
Sisko watched them silently, knowing better than to get in the middle.
"All right," Bosch said. "I saw you talking to that reporter in the hallway, after court. He was from the Times, wasn't he?"
"Yeah, that's right," Holler said. "They have a major skin back to write. That's what he called it, when they have to set the record straight. It's not a correction, because what they went with Sunday came out of court documents. But it was one-sided. It will be the full story tomorrow."
"What was his name?"
"You know, I didn't catch his name. All those guys are the same."
"Was it David Ramsey?"
"I just told you I didn't get the guy's name." Bosch just nodded, and Holler once again saw judgment.
"If you have something to say, then say it," he said. "And stop with the know-it-all judgmental looks."
"I don't have anything to say," Bosch said. "And I don't know it all. But I know what you did."
"For Christ's sakes, what are you talking about?"
"I know what you did."
"Oh, here we go. What did I do, Bosch? Would you just tell me what the fuck you're talking about?"
"You're the leak. You gave the story to the Times on Friday. You're the one who gave it to Ramsey." Sisko was in the middle of a second sip from his martini, the fragile stemmed glass held by his thick fingers. He almost spilled it all over his nice dress vest. No fucking way, he said. Mick would never do...
Yeah, he did, Bosch said. He sold me out to the Times for a headline.
Whoa, 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 Holler said. Are you fucking forgetting something? We won the case, man. And you had a superior court judge apologizing to you and demanding that the DA's office and the LAPD do the same thing. And you're going to complain about my strategy?
So you're saying it was you, Bosch said. You admit it. You and Ramsey.
I'm saying that in order to win the day, we had to raise the stakes, Holler said. We needed to kick this thing out into the street so that it would become public and it would be something that was talked about and would then draw every goddamn news channel in the city to that courtroom today. I knew if we did that, then the judge would have no choice but to give us standing and allow us to intervene.
And you would get, what, about $1 million worth of free publicity out of it?
Jesus Christ, Bosch, you're like a feral cat. You don't trust anybody. I did it for you, not me. And look at what happened.
Holler pointed out of the booth in the direction of the courthouse. The judge let us in over the objections of everybody in the courtroom, he said. And then we fucking won. Borders goes back up to death row for the rest of his sorry existence, and every one of those bastards who tried to set you up and frame you is going to end up disbarred, fired, and probably in jail. Cronin and Cronin are already in jail, while you're sitting here drinking a martini. You think the judge would have given us standing if the media wasn't all over this?
I don't know, Bosch said. But my daughter read that shit Sunday, and has had to wonder for 3 days if her father is the kind of guy who would plant evidence and send an innocent man to death row. On top of that, that story almost got me killed. If that had happened, I'd be dead, and Borders would be walking the earth as a free man to kill again.
Look, I'm sorry about that. I truly am. I didn't want that to happen, and I didn't know you were working undercover because you didn't fucking tell me. But this is one of those rare times where the end justifies the means, okay? We got the result we wanted. Your reputation came out intact. And your daughter is riding that train, knowing her dad is a hero, not a criminal.
Bosch nodded, as though in agreement. But he wasn't.
You should have told me, he said. I'm the client. I should have been informed and given the choice.
And what would your choice have been? Holler asked.
We'll never know now, because you didn't give it to me.
I know what it would have been, and that's why I didn't. End of fucking story.
They stared at each other for a long, hard moment. Sisko hesitantly raised his glass over the middle of the table.
Come on, water under the bridge, fellas, he said. We won. Let's toast again. I can't wait to read the paper tomorrow.
As if each was waiting for the other to make the first move, Holler and Bosch continued their stare down. Holler broke first. He grabbed his glass by the stem and raised it up, sloshing vodka over the brim and down over his fingers. Bosch finally did the same. The three musketeers clinked glasses like swords again, but it no longer seemed much like all for one and one for all.
Chapter 41. As Bosch rounded the last curve on Woodrow Wilson Drive, he saw the city ride parked in front of his house. Someone was waiting for him. He turned the sound down on Kamasi Washington's change of the guard. It was nearly 5, and his plan was to get out of the suit and shower and change into street clothes before heading up to the valley to visit Elizabeth Clayton in the dungeon where she was taking the cure. As he pulled into the side carport, he saw who it was. Lucia Soto was sitting on the house's front step, looking at her phone. Bosch parked and walked around to the front, rather than avoiding her and going through the side door. She stood up, put the phone away, and wiped dust from the step off the back of her pants. She was still in the dark blue suit she had worn in court that morning.
Been waiting long? Bosch asked by way of a greeting.
No, she said. I had some emailing to do.
You should sweep your steps every now and then, Harry.
Dusty.
Keep forgetting. How'd they take things today down at RHD?
Oh, you know, in stride. They always take things, good and bad, in stride.
And was it a good or bad thing?
I think good.
Whenever a former detective is cleared of wrongdoing, that's a good thing. Even if it is Harry Bosch. She smiled. He frowned and unlocked the door. He pushed it open for her.
Enter, he said. I'm out of beer, but I have some pretty good bourbon.
That sounds right, she said.
Bosch entered behind her, and then moved by so he could get to the living room first and make it a little more hospitable for a visitor. The past two nights he had fallen asleep on the couch, watching television and trying to clear his mind of all things related to his cases. He squared up the couch pillows and grabbed the shirt draped over the arm. He headed back toward the kitchen with it. Have a seat and I'll get the glasses.
Can we go out on the deck? I like it out there and it's been a while.
Sure, there's a broomstick in the slider track.
That's new.
He put the shirt in the washer, which was located by the kitchen side door to the carport. He grabbed the bottle off the top of the refrigerator and took two glasses down from a shelf before joining Soto on the deck.
Yeah, there's been a couple break-ins in the neighborhood lately, he said.
Both times a guy climbed up a tree to get on the roof and then came down on the back deck, where people sometimes don't lock their doors. He gestured with the bottle toward the house next door, which was cantilevered like Bosch's. The rear deck hung out over the canyon and seemed impossible to get to, other than from inside. But it was clear the roof gave access. Soto nodded. Bosch could tell she wasn't really interested. She wasn't visiting as part of the neighborhood watch committee. He opened the bottle and poured a healthy slug into each of the glasses. He handed one to Soto, but they didn't toast. Considering everything between them at the moment, it would not have felt right.
So did he tell you how he did it? Bosch asked.
Who? Soto said. How who did what?
Come on.
Spencer. How'd he rig the evidence box?
Spencer hasn't told us jack shit, Harry.
His lawyer won't let him talk to us, and he said he wasn't going to testify either.
Your lawyer lied to the judge during the proffer.
No, he didn't lie. Not to the judge, at least. Check the record. He said Spencer was in the hallway and was ready to take the stand. That wasn't a lie. Whether he was going to testify once he got up there or take the fifth was another matter.
Semantics, Harry. I never knew you to hide behind words.
It was a bluff, and it worked. If it makes you feel any better, I didn't know about it. But it got the truth out, didn't it?
It did. And it got us a search warrant.
We didn't need Spencer to talk.
Bosch looked sharply at her. She had solved the mystery.
Tell me.
We opened his locker. He had a stack of the 20-year-old evidence stickers they put on the boxes back then. They were supposed to be destroyed when we went to the red crackle tape, but somehow he got a leftover stack and kept it.
So he opened the box, planted Ulmer's DNA, and put new labels on it.
He opened the bottom seam, because your signature was on the labels on top, and because his labels were old and yellow, the box looked totally legit. The thing is, we don't think it was the only time. We got a search warrant for his house, too, and we found some receipts from a pawn shop in Glendale. We checked there, and he's a regular customer, selling jewelry mostly. We think he might have been raiding boxes from closed cases looking for valuables to pawn. He probably thought since the cases were old and closed, nobody would ever look.
So when Cronin asked Spencer if he could get something into a box, he said no problem.
Exactly.
Bosch nodded. The mystery was solved.
What about the Cronins, he asked.
I assume they're going for a one-for-one deal, right?
Probably, she said.
She walks and he takes the hit. He'll get disbarred, but then he'll just prop her up. Everyone will know that if you hire her, you hire him.
And that's it?
No jail time? The guy used the law to try to break a killer out of prison, death row no less. He gets a slap on the wrist?
Well, last I heard, they were still in jail because Houghton won't set bail tomorrow. Anyway, it's early in negotiations, Harry. But Spencer still isn't talking, and the only one who is talking is Borders. When your one and only witness is a murderer on death row, you don't have a case you want to take to a jury. This is going to come down to plea agreements all around, and maybe Cronin goes to jail. Maybe not. Truth is, they're more interested in nailing Spencer, because he was inside the wire. He betrayed the department.
Bosch nodded. He understood the thinking on Spencer.
The department's management team has already moved in, Soto said.
They're revamping the whole booking and retrieving process so that something like this can never happen again.
Bosch moved to the wooden railing and leaned his elbows down. It was still at least an hour from sundown. The 101 freeway down in the pass was clogged in both directions, but there were very few sounds of horns. Drivers in L.A. seemed resigned to a fate of waiting in traffic, without the kind of impotent cacophony of horns that Bosch always seemed to hear in other cities he'd visited. He always thought his deck gave him a unique angle on that distinctive L.A. trait. Soto joined him at the railing and leaned down next to him.
"I didn't really come up here to talk about the case," she said.
"I know," Bosch said. She nodded. It was time to get to it.
"A really good detective who used to mentor me taught me to always follow the evidence. That's what I thought I was doing with this thing. But somewhere I got manipulated, or I took a wrong turn, and I ended up where the evidence told me something my heart should have known was flat out wrong. For that I'm truly sorry, Harry. And I always will be."
"Thank you, Lucia." Bosch nodded. He knew she could have easily blamed it all on Tapscott. He was the senior detective in the partnership, and he called the final shots on case decisions. Instead, she put it all on herself. She took the weight. That took guts, and that took a true detective. Bosch had to admire her for that. Besides, how could he hold anything against Soto, when he had heard in his own daughter's voice a worry that it all might be true, that Harry had fixed a case against an innocent man? "So," Lucia asked, "are we good again, Harry?"
"We're good," Bosch said, "but I sure hope people read the paper tomorrow."
"Fuck anybody who still has a doubt after today."
"I'll go with that."
Soto straightened up. She had said what she'd come to say and was ready to go home. Soon she would be in the iron ribbon of traffic he was staring down at. She poured the remainder of her bourbon into Bosch's glass.
"I gotta go."
"Okay. Thanks for coming here to talk. It means a lot, Lucia."
"Harry, if you need anything or there's anything I can do for you, I owe you. Thanks for the booze."
She headed for the open slider. Bosch turned and leaned back against the railing.
"There is, actually," he said. "Something you could do."
She stopped and turned around.
"Daisy Clayton," he said.
She shook her head, not getting it.
"Am I supposed to know that name?"
Bosch shook his head and stood straight.
"No. She was a murder victim from before you ever made it to homicide. But you're on cold cases. I want you to pull the file and work it."
"Who was she?"
"She was a nobody, and nobody cared. That's why her case is still open."
"I mean, who was she to you?"
"I never knew her. She was only 15 years old. But there's somebody out there who took her, then used her, and then threw her away like trash. Somebody evil. I can't work the case because it's Hollywood. Not my turf anymore. But it is yours."
"You know what year?"
'09. Soto nodded. She had what she needed, at least to pull the case and review it.
"Okay, Harry, I'm on it."
"Thank you."
"I'll tell you what I know when I know it."
"Good.
See you, Harry."
"See you, Lucia."
Chapter 42. After showering and changing into street clothes, Bosch went to the closet next to the front door and pulled the fireproof box off the shelf. He used a key to open it. It contained old legal documents, including birth certificates and his discharge papers from the U.S. Army. Bosch kept his wedding ring in the box, as well as his two purple hearts and the two life insurance policies that listed his daughter as beneficiary. There was also a faded color photo of Bosch and his mother. It was the only photograph of her he had, so he had always wanted to keep it safe, rather than display it. He looked at it now for a few moments, this time his eyes drawn to his own image at 8 years old, rather than to his mother's. He studied the hopefulness in the boy's face and wondered where it had gone. He put the photo to the side and dug further into the strong box until he found what he was looking for. It was an old sock, stuffed with a rubber-banded roll of money. Without pulling it out of the sock now,
or counting it. Bosch shoved it into the side pocket of his jacket. The roll of money was the earthquake fund, mostly large bills he had been accumulating slowly, a 20 here and a 50 there, since the last big earthquake in 1994. In L.A., nobody wanted to be stuck without cash when the big one hit. ATMs would be knocked offline, and banks would be closed in a time of civic catastrophe. Cash would be king, and Bosch had been planning accordingly for over 20 years. By his estimate, there was close to $10,000 in the sock. He put the other items back into the box, taking one last look at the mother and son photo. He had no recollection of posing for the shot, or where it had been taken. It was a professional shot, with a white, now yellowed background. Maybe young Harry had tagged along with her when she had gotten headshots for her efforts to be cast as a movie extra. Maybe she then paid the photographer a little more for a quick photo with her son. Bosch drove up the hill to Mulholland, and then followed the snake to Laurel Canyon Boulevard, which dropped him down the north side into the valley. As soon as he got bars on his phone, he called Bella Lourdes on her cell. He expected she would be off duty and home by now. Still, she answered right away. "Harry, I was going to call you, but I thought maybe you'd be out celebrating." "Oh, you mean the case?" "No, no celebration. Just glad it's over." "I'll say. Well, I was going to call you to tell you they ID'd the other Russian off his prints. You know how you were calling him Igor for the sake of keeping all the parties straight when you were telling the story?" "Yeah." "Well, the guy's name actually was Igor. I mean, what are the chances?" "Probably pretty good if you're Russian." "Anyway, Igor Golz, G-O-L-Z, age 31. Interpol had him as another member of the Bratva and longtime associate of Sluchek's. They met in a Russian prison and probably came over here together." "Well, I guess that wraps things up on the Farmacia case, huh?" "I was nailing down the paperwork today. You back in tomorrow, now that your court thing is over?" "Yeah, my thingy's over, and I'll be in tomorrow." "Sorry, you know what I mean. It'll be nice to have you back around." "Listen, I was calling to ask you something. The other day you mentioned that you had been around addicts, including someone in your own family. Do you mind if I ask who that was?"
"Yeah, my sister."
"Why do you want to know?"
"Is she all right now? I mean, not addicted."
"As far as we know, we don't see her that much. Once she got clean, she didn't really want to be around the people who saw her at her low points. You know what I mean?"
"I think so. She stole like crazy from my parents. Me too."
"That's what happens."
"So we saved her, but consequently we lost her, at least in a good way. She lives up in the Bay Area, and like I said, she's supposedly 4 years sober and clean."
"That part's great. How did you get her clean?"
"Well, we didn't actually do it. It was rehab."
"Which one did you use? That's why I'm calling. I need to get somebody into a place, and I don't know where to start."
"Well, there's the fancy ones that cost a fortune and those that don't. You get what you pay for as far as creature comforts, but my sister was basically on the streets. So the place we got her into was like heaven. A room and a bed, you know? It was a mixture of circle jerks and private sessions with the shrinks. A piss test every day."
"Where was it? What was it called?"
"It was called The Start. It was over there in Canoga Park. 4 years ago, it was like $1,200 a week. There was no insurance, so we all chipped in. It's gotta be more now. The opioid thing has made it hard to find a bed in some of these places."
"Thanks, Bella. I'm gonna check it out."
"See you tomorrow at the station?"
"I'll be there." Bosch was on the 101, transitioning north to the 405. He could see the plume of smoke from the brewery up ahead. He called directory assistance and was connected to The Start. After being put on hold twice, he was finally speaking to someone called the director of placement. She explained that the facility specialized in treating opioid addiction and that they did not reserve beds, choosing to work strictly on a first-come, first-served basis. At the moment, there were 3 beds open in the 42-bed facility. Bosch asked about pricing and learned that the weekly all-inclusive fee had jumped more than 50% in 4 years to $1,880, paid in advance with a recommended 4-week minimum of treatment. Bosch was reminded of Jerry Edgar's sermon about the crisis being too big to shut down
because everybody was making money on it.
Bosch thanked the director of placement and disconnected. 5 minutes later, he was pulling into the Road Saints compound. This time there were several motorcycles parked about the front yard, and he wondered if he had stumbled into the monthly membership meeting. Before getting out of the Jeep, he called Cisco to see if he had arrived at the wrong time.
No, man. I'll come out and bring you in. Wednesdays are always big here for some reason. I don't even know why.
Bosch was leaning against the Jeep when Cisco came out.
So how's she doing? He asked.
Resentful as ever, Cisco said. But I think that's a good sign. I remember Mick Haller came to visit me when I was in a day 4 or 5. I told him through the door that he could take his job and shove it up his ass. Of course, a week later I had to ask him to pull it out of his ass and give it back to me.
Bosch laughed.
So have you heard about this place over in Canoga Park, called The Start? He asked.
Yeah, the rehab, Cisco said. I've heard of it, but I don't really know anything about it.
I heard from somebody that it was good. It got results for them. Cost about $2,000 a week, so it better.
That's a lot of bread.
When Elizabeth is finished here, I want you to take her there. Try to get her in. It's first come, first served, but there are beds open now. I think she's going to need at least another day here, maybe 2, before she gets cleaned up and can take that next step.
That's fine. Whenever she's ready.
Bosch reached into the pocket of his jacket and pulled out the sock containing the cash roll. He handed it to Cisco.
Use this. It should get a month at that place. Maybe longer if she needs it.
Cisco reluctantly took it.
This is cash? You just want to give it to me?
Cisco looked around the yard and through the fencing to the outside streets. Bosch realized how it might look to anyone watching.
Shit. I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking.
Now Bosch looked around. He saw no signs of surveillance, but he probably wouldn't have.
No worries, Cisco said. For a good cause.
So you'll handle that? Bosch asked.
You've been paying forward, backward, and sideways with this.
I don't mind. We're doing a good thing.
You want to go in now?
You know what? I was thinking maybe I shouldn't. If she's going to get agitated, then she doesn't need to see me. I don't want to set her off.
You sure?
Yeah, if she's doing good, keep her doing good. I'm happy with that.
Cisco tossed the sock up and then caught it.
Let me guess, he said. Earthquake money.
Yeah, Bosch said. I thought, what the hell? Put it to good use.
Yeah, but you know you just jinxed the whole city. As soon as you spend the earthquake money, the big one hits. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to see. I'll let you get back to it.
Thanks, Cisco.
No, thank you. And someday I think she'll be doing the thanking.
Not necessary now, not necessary then. Let me know how it goes with that other place if you get her in.
Will do.
After driving away, Bosch cut west and went by The Start after Googling its location on his phone. He could tell it had once been a Holiday Inn or some other mid-range hotel. It was now painted stark white. It looked clean and cared for, at least on the outside. He was happy with that. He kept driving and started heading home. Almost the whole way, he thought about his decision not to go in and visit Elizabeth Clayton. He wasn't sure what that meant or what he was doing. She had tapped into a need he had to reach out and help someone, whether they welcomed his help or not. He was sure that if he sat down with the shrink for an hour, maybe his longtime LAPD counselor, Carmen Hinojos, there would be a whole raft of psychological underpinnings to his actions. And the money. He had very specifically committed funds that would not upset any financial aspect of his life. So there was a sacrifice in that? There had been a time when Bosch as a boy, obviously wanting to escape his life in youth halls and foster homes, had become fascinated with the great explorers who had discovered new lands and cultures. Men who had left their places and stations in life to find something new or to stand against something old, like slavery. As he traveled from one bed to another, the one thing he carried from place to place was a book about the Scottish missionary and explorer David Livingstone, who had done both. Bosch didn't remember the title of the book anymore,
but he remembered many of the ideas the man espoused. Over time, he had cemented them, like a mason into his own belief system, and they formed the brick foundation of who he was as both a detective and a man. Livingston had said sympathy was no substitute for action. There was an essential brick in Bosch's wall. He had built himself as a man of action, and at the moment when the integrity of his life's work had been called into question by a man on death row, he had chosen to turn his sympathy for Elizabeth Clayton into action. He understood, but was unsure if anyone else would. They would see other motives. Elizabeth would as well, and that was why he had not chosen to see her. He knew he had done what he needed to do, and that he would probably never see her again. It was only 9 when he reached home, but Bosch was exhausted and looking forward to crashing into his bed for the first time in almost a week. He got in, checked the locks, and put the broomstick back into the track of the deck slider. He then walked down the hall, dropping his jacket and shirt on the floor as he went. He finished getting undressed and crawled into bed, ready to completely succumb to sleep's rehab and restoration. When he reached over to the clock so he could push the daily 6 a.m. alarm back a couple hours, he saw a folded envelope on the bed table. He unfolded it to find that it was addressed to him at the SFPD station. He suddenly thought someone had been in the house and put the envelope there for him to find. Then his weary mind focused, and he remembered placing the letter there 3 nights earlier. He had completely forgotten about it and had not slept in the bed since. He decided the letter could wait until morning. He adjusted the alarm, turned off the lights, and put his head between 2 pillows. He lasted no more than 30 seconds. He pulled the top pillow away, reached up, and turned the light back on. He opened the envelope. It contained a folded newspaper clip. It was the San Fernando Valley Sun story from almost a year earlier, reporting on the department's renewed effort to find out what had happened to Esmeralda Tavares. Bosch had given the interview to a reporter for the local weekly, hoping to spawn feedback and possible information from the public. A few tips had come in, but nothing of merit, nothing that panned out. And now, a year later, this letter. The clip was accompanied by a piece of white paper, folded 3 times. In a handwritten scrawl, it said, "I know what happened to Esme Tavares." The note included the name Angela, and a phone number with an 818 area code. The Valley. Bosch got up and reached for his phone. Chapter 43. Angela Martinez, the author of the note to Bosch, turned out to know exactly what had happened to Esmeralda Tavares, because she was Esmeralda Tavares. On Wednesday night, Bosch called the number on the letter he had received, and the woman who identified herself as Angela said she would meet him at 9 the next morning at her home in Woodland Hills. The woman who answered the door of the condo on Topanga Canyon Boulevard was blonde and in her mid-30s. Bosch had spent a lot of time over the previous 2 years looking at photographs of the dark-haired, dark-eyed Esme Tavares of 15 years before. He had one shot of her, her lips pursed in a pout, posted in the cell, so that he would always be reminded of the case. He had chosen the pout photo out of all the rest because he knew the set of a person's closed mouth changed little over time. The woman who called herself Angela wasn't smiling when she answered the door, and he knew right away that she was Esme. And she recognized that he knew. "You have to stop looking for me," she said. They sat in her living room and she told him her story. Once she got going, he could have filled in the details ahead of her, but he let her tell it just the same. Young woman caught in a bad marriage to an older, dominating man, physically abused regularly, and tied to a baby she never wanted to have, that her husband wanted only as a means of controlling her. She made the hard choice to leave everything behind, including the child, and disappear. She had help, and when Bosch probed deeper with his questions, it became clear that help came from a lover she had had on the side at the time, and had now lived with for 15 years. They had first moved away and lived in Salt Lake City together. They came back 10 years later, because both missed the city where they had grown up. Her story had more holes in it than a San Pedro fishing net, but Bosch thought the omissions and incongruities were designed to cast her in the best light in a place of deep shadows. She seemed to show no guilt about the daughter she had left in a crib, or about the efforts of the community to find her. She professed to be unaware of all of that, because she was then living in Salt Lake City. She also claimed that her disappearance was not an effort in any way to cast suspicion on the husband she left behind. She said she had no alternative but to run. "If I had just tried to leave him, he would have killed me," she said. "Admit it, he thought he had killed me." "That might be true," Bosch said, "but that was at least in part dictated by the circumstances of you disappearing with the baby left in the crib." In the end, Angela Martinez, née Esmeralda Tavares, was singularly unapologetic for what she had done. Not to Bosch, the police, or the community. And most of all, not to her baby daughter, whom her husband gave up for adoption a year after his wife was gone. "Do you even know where she is?" Bosch asked, the dispassionate detective pose, not working at the moment. "Wherever it is, I'm sure she's in a better place than if I had stayed in that house of horrors," Martinez said. "She might not have survived it. I know I wouldn't have. But how did you know he would give her up once you were gone? She could still be in that house of horrors as far as he knew back then." "No, I knew he would give her up. He only wanted her so I would be tied to him. I proved him very wrong." Bosch thought about the intervening years and all the efforts to find her. He thought about Detective Valdez, now the chief of police, haunted by the case for so long. Bosch knew that on one level it was a good outcome. The mystery was solved, and Esme was alive. But Bosch didn't feel good about it. "Why now?" Bosch said. "Why'd you reach out now?" "Albert and I want to get married," she said. "It's time. My husband never divorced me. That's how controlling he was. He never had me declared dead, but I hired a lawyer and he'll handle it now. The first step was to solve the mystery that everybody's been so worked up about for so long." She smiled as though she was proud of her actions, energized by knowing she had kept the secret for so long. "Aren't you still afraid of him? Your husband?" Bosch asked. "Not anymore," she said. "I was just a girl then. He doesn't scare me now." Her smile had now turned into the pout from the photo Bosch had hung in the cell where he worked. He stood up. "I think I have what I need to close this out," he said. "That's all you need to know?" she asked. She seemed surprised. "For now," Bosch said. "I'll get back to you if there's anything else." "Well, you know where to find me," she said. "Finally." Bosch headed to the station after that. He was morose. He was coming in with another case closed, but there was nothing to feel good about. A lot of people had spent time, money, and emotions on Esme Tavares. As had always been suspected, Esme Tavares was dead. But Angela Martinez was alive. After parking at SFPD, he made a swing through the detective bureau on his way to the main interior hallway of the station. The pods were empty, and Bosch heard voices from the war room. He suspected the detectives were taking a joint lunch break. The chief of police's office was located at the center of the station and across a hallway from the watch lieutenant's office. Bosch stuck his head in the door and asked Valdez's secretary if the boss had a free 5 minutes. He knew that once he got in the room with the man, the conversation would likely last a lot longer. The secretary called back to the room behind her desk and got an approval. Bosch stepped in. Valdez was in uniform as usual and seated behind his desk. He held up the A section of the Times.
"Just reading about you, Harry," he said. "They exonerated you pretty good here. Congratulations."
Bosch sat down across the desk from him. "Thanks," he said. Bosch had read the story that morning before heading off to his appointment and was satisfied with it. However, he knew that more people read the Sunday edition of the Times than the Thursday paper. There was always going to be a gulf between those who had read that he was a crooked cop and those who read the "Never Mind, He's Straight" story. It didn't bother him too much. The one person he wanted most to read the latest story had already seen it online and had texted him, saying that she was very proud of him and happy with the outcome of the Borders case.
"So," he said,
I'm not sure how to tell you this, so I'll just tell you. I just met Esme Tavares. She's alive and well and living in Woodland Hills. Valdez almost came out of his seat. He leaned violently forward across the desk, his face showing a surprise.
What?
Bosch ran down the story, beginning with him opening the letter the night before.
Mother of God, Valdez said. I've had her as dead for 15 years. Let me tell you, many was the night I wanted to go to that house and drag that asshole husband of hers behind the back of my car until he told me where she was buried.
I know. Me too.
I mean, Christ, I fell in love with her. You know how you do with victims sometimes?
Yeah, I had a little bit of that too. Until today.
So did she tell you why?
Bosch recounted the conversation he'd had that morning with Angela Martinez. As he told it, Valdez's face grew increasingly dark with anger. He shook his head several times and wrote some notes down on a scratch pad on his desk. When Bosch was finished, the chief checked his notes before speaking.
Did you advise her? He asked.
Bosch knew he was asking if Bosch had informed Martinez of her constitutional rights to an attorney and to avoid self-incrimination.
No, Bosch said. I didn't think I had to.
She called me to her place and we sat in her living room. I identified myself and she obviously knew who I was. But it doesn't matter, Chief. I know what you're thinking, and those things never work out.
This is fraud, Valdez said. Over the years, we've spent probably close to $500,000 looking for her. I remember when she was first reported missing, the overtime was flowing like an open fire hydrant. It was all hands on deck. And then we've never let up, right on up to you taking the case and running with it.
Look, I hate to come off as defending her, but she committed a moral crime, not a crime that the DA will find prosecutable. She was escaping from what she considered a dangerous situation. She was long gone before the overtime and everything else started flowing. She can claim she didn't know or that it was too dangerous to call in and say she was okay. She's got a lot of defenses. The DA won't touch it. The chief didn't respond. He leaned back in his chair and stared at a toy police helicopter hanging on a string from the ceiling. He liked to say it was the tiny department's air squadron.
Shit, he finally said.
I wish there was something we could do about it. We just have to live with it, Bosch said. She was in a bad situation back then. She made the wrong choice. But people are flawed. They're selfish. All this time we thought she was dead, she was pure and innocent to us. Now we find out she was the kind that would leave a baby in a crib to save herself. Bosch thought about Jose Esquivel Jr. dying with his cheek on the linoleum in the back hallway of his father's business. He wondered if anybody was pure and innocent. Valdez got up from his desk and went to the bulletin board over the low row of filing cabinets against the right wall. He flipped back some deployment sheets, then weeded through a stack of wanted flyers until he found the missing leaflet with a photo of Esme Tavares on it, circa 2002. He tore it off the board and crumpled it between his hands, crushing the ball as small as he could. He then fired a shot at a trash can at the end of the file cabinets. He missed.
"What's this world about, Harry?" he asked.
"I don't know," Bosch said. "This week I closed out a double murder and a 15-year-old missing persons case. I don't feel good about any of it." Valdez dropped back into his seat.
"You gotta feel good about the Farmacia caper," he said. "You took two pieces of shit off the board."
Bosch nodded. But the truth was, it felt to him like he was walking in circles. True justice was the brass ring just out of reach. Bosch stood up.
"You going to call up Carlos and tell him he's off the hook?" he asked.
Carlos Tavares was Esmeralda's husband, 15 years a suspect.
"Fuck him," Valdez said. "He's still an asshole. He can read it about it in the paper."
Bosch went to the door, and then looked back at his boss. "I'll have the report on this finished today," he said.
"Good," Valdez said. "Then we go drinking."
"That sounds right." Chapter 44 Bosch wanted to avoid the detective bureau. He didn't want to talk anymore. Bella Lourdes and others would find out soon enough about Esme Tavares being alive and well, and it would be the talk of the department,
and then the whole town. But Bosch had talked about it enough for the time being. He walked out the front door of the station and then crossed the street. He went through the public works yard and into the jail. After unlocking his cell, he slid the heavy steel door open, and it banged hard against its frame. Like the police chief, Bosch went to the photo of Esme Tavares to yank it down. But then he stopped. He decided to leave it in place, so he would always see it, and it would remind him about how wrong he had been about the case. It was the child in the crib that had misled him. He knew this. It seemed against all laws of nature, and so it had led him, and many others before him, down the wrong path. He stood there looking at the photo, and considered the irony of the week. Elizabeth Clayton couldn't recover from the loss of a child, and wandered the earth as a zombie, not caring what was done to her, or what depravity she had willingly sunk to. Esme Tavares left the child in a crib, and apparently never looked back. The reality of the world was dark and horrifying. Bosch sat down behind his makeshift desk to do the paperwork that would document the grim reality of it, but he found that he couldn't even begin. He contemplated this for a long moment, and then stood back up. There was a bench that ran down the center of the cell perpendicular to his desk. He used it mostly to spread out photos and files so that he could review stubborn cases from a fresh angle, often looking at the crime scene photos placed side by side down the length of the scarred wooden bench. He had been told that the bench had been nicknamed the diving board back in the day because it had been the jumping-off point to oblivion for a handful of inmates over time. They would step up on the bench, wrap one leg from their jail pants through the bars, guarding the overhead air vent, then wrap the other around their neck. They'd jump off the end of the bench into the dark pool of emptiness, and their misery would be over. Bosch stepped up onto the bench now. He reached above his head to grasp one of the overhead bars for support. He dug into his pocket and pulled out his phone. Checking the screen, he held the phone up, turning on the bench, moving his arm until he saw one service bar finally appear in the corner. With his thumb, he went to his contact list and scrolled until almost the end and hit the number he was looking for. Lucia Soto answered right away.
"Harry, what's up?
Did you pull that case I told you about?"
"Daisy Clayton? Yes, first thing this morning."
"And?"
"You were right. Gathering dust.
Nobody's worked it in 3-4 years except for the annual due diligence reports, which are word-for-word copies of the year before. You know how it goes. No viable leads at this time because they didn't really look for viable leads."
"And?"
"And I think they were wrong. I saw some stuff. There are workable angles. It was pretty much written off as a serial. Somebody who moved through Hollywood did his thing and moved on. But I'm not so sure about that. I looked at the photos. There was a familiarity with her and the place where she was left. He knew the area. I'm going to..."
"Lucia?"
"What, Harry?"
"Cut me in."
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean. I want in.
Let's go get him."
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Two Kinds of Truth, written by Michael Connelly, read by Titus Welliver. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Cale. Sound editing by Jennifer Nix and Sean Bolter. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Two Kinds of Truth is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Hieronymus, Inc. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.